Started out as a night of fun for five teenage friends, turned into an absolute nightmare, and it actually took away the identity of Sandra Chesky. She became known as Gitchy Girl, the one who went out into the woods on the Iowa-South Dakota border one Saturday evening to de-stress from the school week. It was just a night about five friends enjoying themselves around a campfire under the stars, smoke a few joints, and play a little guitar. She became the one who survived. Now, teenagers who always stayed out of trouble, but on this night, trouble came looking for them. When four of them ended up dead and one sexually assaulted, it would be a night that would forever change the tight-knit community of Sioux Falls, South Dakota. This is the creepy case of the Gitche Manitou murders. Welcome to another episode of Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces. I am your host, Cassie Opea. Don't forget, I bring you every Friday a new episode of the creepiest true crime cases, some which are actually unsolved to this very day, and the spookiest spaces from around the world. If you subscribe to the Patreon or the Anchor page, Anchor is supplied through Spotify, you actually get bonus episodes every other Tuesday, a merchandise discount, a shout out a future episode, and my never-ending gratitude. If you would like to support without subscribing, I have a Cash App and a Venmo, and also just buying merchandise in the Wick and Fae shop at pizzaandpigtails.com. You definitely help support the podcast that way as well. And also just following on social media, liking, sharing, commenting, spreading the word about the podcast, joining in on the conversation with your fellow fiends, that also helps. If you're a small business like myself, or a big business, because I don't discriminate, and you're looking to get your content or your products spread out to a wider audience as well, I do have ad space coming up in future episodes, so definitely send me a message at creepycases.spookyspaces@gmail.com, and I can send you all of my budget-friendly packages. So before I get into this week's creepy case slash spooky space, it's actually a little bit of both. I'm just going to throw out that disclaimer. This does talk about murder. It talks about murder of young teenagers. It talks about sexual assault. And it's actually quite a frustrating episode, once again. But this time it wasn't due to police negligence or the police work. It's just a very frustrating story to research or listen to. It's very sad, though. I think it's more sad than anything else. But let's get started on this week's episode. Now, I originally started this episode as a spooky space until I started researching further and found there are many reasons that Gitche Manitou State Preserve is a spooky space. Iowa parks are recognized as some of the most beautiful and peaceful areas in the country, and Gitche Manitou lives up to that claim. Now, Gitche Manitou means great spirit in Anishinaabe. With the Big Sioux River running through it, expansive prairie land, rock outcrops, and quartzite cones, which are the oldest bedrock in the state, which were built by the natives, it's over 1.6 billion years old. In 1916, the state of Iowa purchased 47.5 acres to use as a first rock quarry. They ended up transferring the land over to the Board of Conservation, and in the 1930s, a stone shelter was built by the Conservation Corps. It now stands as a graffiti-covered ruins. In 1969, the land was officially dedicated as a geological, archaeological, historical, and biological state park preserve. People who have visited have reported a feeling of being watched and general unease. Cold spots arise, while people also get an overwhelming sense of sadness. Some visitors have fallen ill and become disoriented, and they get lost and travel deep into the woods. And even after their trip, they continue being disoriented and have been seen muttering nonsense to themselves. An overall negative energy lies in certain areas of the park. Visitors feel as if they're being attacked, and they've seen a black figure and have heard drum beats, like those of Native American, like warning that danger is approaching. Around Jasper Pond, there has been a growling and grunting in clear open areas where there are no animals nearby. In the 1970s, a group that was picnicking at the reserve reported hearing strange noises followed by a whistle. Now, the sounds continued to get closer, and they spotted a man they say was around 7 feet tall wearing a blue suit. He emerged from like the foliage areas, and they just could not take their eyes off of him. And another, like, pulsating, glowing object the size of a haystack emerged from the large wooded area behind him. After a few seconds, both entities just disappeared. But the foliage where the man was standing remained undisturbed. Now, Gitche Manitou State Preserve, a spooky reputation, could be traced back to being a Native American burial ground, or it could possibly be the many travelers who came through in the 1800s carrying illness and disease. Or maybe it could be linked to the tragic murders of 4 teenagers in 1973. On November 17th, 13-year-old Sandra Chesky, a Harrisburg 7th grader who had moved to Sioux Falls, South Dakota the previous year and was just kind of finding her way around in the world. She was making friends and even dating 17-year-old Roger Essam. Now, it was Roger who invited Sandra out with him and his friends, 18-year-old Stuart Bade, his younger brother, 14-year-old Dana, their 15-year-old friend Mike Hadreth, to Gitche Manitou, which is located in Leon County, just over the state line in northwest Iowa. It was a good place to hike and also a well-known party spot. This night wasn't really about partying, though. It was just a few friends headed out for a carefree evening to relax and enjoy a campfire under the stars. So they all hopped in to Stuart's blue van and headed out, blissfully unaware that only one of them would survive the night. They got to the state preserve, parking the van by the stone ruins I told you about earlier, and made their way to the woods. They got the campfire set up, and with the Big Sioux River just a few yards behind them, they shared stories and a few joints while Stuart strummed his guitar that he carried with him pretty much everywhere. It was only about 20 minutes or so later that they had settled in, and they began to hear twigs snapping nearby. So Roger got up to investigate. This was when someone opened fire, shooting and killing Roger Essam and wounding Stuart Bade. The remaining teens ran into the woods for cover, but they were ordered to come out. Sandra and Mike came out side by side and were face to face with 3 men. Mike then asked who they were and what they wanted, and one of them responded by shooting him in the arm. Both he and Sandra fell to the ground, but one of the men walked over and kicked their feet, saying he knew that they were playing dead and they needed to get up. He told them that they were narcotics officers who were there because the teen had drugs on them and they would have to confiscate. The three teens, Sandra, Dana, and Mike, were forced into the woods at gunpoint by two men who were referred as Hatchet Face and Junior, while the other man, who was referred to as Boss, went to get his truck. Stuart was still on the ground, but he was out of sight. The rest of the teens could hear him crying out, "I've been shot, it hurts, it hurts." Now, a few minutes later, the two men stopped, discussed something quietly, and one of them turned back. And just a few minutes later, he returned with Stuart. Boss also returned with the truck. He tied up Sandra, put her in, and drove off. She later recalled that this was the last time she had seen her friends alive. They were all standing on the side of the roadway. Hatchet Face and Junior lined the three teenage boys, and let's be honest, two of them were closer to being children than really anything else. They lined them up in front of Stuart's van, shooting them at close range and killing them. Now, the boss told Sandra he was a police officer, while he drove her around for about an hour or so before stopping at an abandoned farmhouse near Hartford, South Dakota, where the other two men soon met up with them. When they got there, Boss got out of the truck and Junior got in, ripping Sandra's clothes off and brutally sexually assaulting her. Afterwards, Boss got back into the truck while the other men left, and when he told them he would take care of Sandra, I think they believed he was going to kill her. Well, he grabbed a club and told Sandra that she needed to get out of the truck and go into the house with him to hunt critters. She refused to go in because she knew that if she did, she wouldn't be coming out alive. So after she pleaded with him, he finally gave in and told her that he would take her home. He filled his truck with gas from a large red gas tank that was next to the garage. And he said to her while driving, "Well, that wasn't so bad, was it?" And Sandra replied, "I was a virgin." And he said, "Nah, no you ain't." She then told him that she was only 13, and he told her he would take her home if she kept quiet, and when she got out of the truck, he said, "There, now I know where you live." A Sioux Falls couple, while visiting the preserve, testing out their new car, found the bodies of Stuart, Dana, and Mike the next morning. Since he was left in a different area, it took them an additional day to find Roger's body. Investigators carefully combed through the grisly scene, and they found spent shell casings from a 12, 16, and 20-gauge shotguns, knowing that there were three shooters, or at least three guns. Now, Stuart's 1967 blue van was nowhere to be found, however. The next morning, Sandra heard the news that her friends had all been killed the night before. She put her fear aside, and that very afternoon, she went to police, telling them that she was with the murdered teens. She reported that three men had approached them and shot her friends. She said she was told that they were just shot with tranquilizer guns, and he told her that they would take her home after she was sexually assaulted. Now, at first, police didn't really believe Sandra. They wondered why she was spared when everyone else wasn't. But her story stayed the same, and all the details were constant, not a single one changed. And she passed a lie detector test. They kept her locked in a juvenile detention center, which at first when I read this, I was like, could you imagine? Like, can you even fathom going and telling the police this story and being locked up anyway? Now, then I found that they kept her in the juvenile detention center because they wanted to keep her safe and they just didn't know where the best place for her would be because, like she said, they knew where she lived, so they were a little worried about sending her back home. Sandra underwent days of questioning, giving police as many details as she could recall. The description of the house with the red gas tank, the truck. It was brown, with a gun rack, a crack in the windshield, and an inspection sticker in a specific location on the dash. And while I was reading this, I kind of became just in awe of Sandra, because she handled this situation beautifully. She remained calm in a very traumatic and terrifying situation. She took in her surroundings. She remembered a lot of details. And while things could have gone a lot worse for her, it was a good thing that she kind of kept her wits about her, because she was able to get all of this information. She gave a description of the killers, and police made and distributed sketches, but they failed to bring in any leads, and it kind of felt helpless. Now, Sheriff Craig Vinson drove her around for a good 10 days or so. And at one point, he actually pulled over onto a back road, which, why would you do this to somebody who was just through this situation? Like, I can only imagine. Like, come on. And he told her, "I know you know who these guys are. Tell me right now." Now, this actually worked against the sheriff, because it actually made Sandra shut down, and she stopped even trying to look for any details while they drove around, until they went out for a drive on November 29th, and they came across the house. Sandra pointed out the big red gasoline tank, and as if the heavens had opened up and just perfectly timed this, that very brown truck she was kidnapped and assaulted in drove by slowly, and Sandra noticed. She yelled out, "That's him, that's the boss." She was told to get down in the seat as police took off after him. Now, upon pulling him over, the details of the truck were exactly as she described. Everything matched perfectly. When asked, the driver tells police that he knows nothing about the murders and nothing about the teenagers. This would be when they arrest him, and later arrested the other two men the same day. Now, the next day, November 30th, Sandra identifies all three men in a lineup using their nicknames. And this is when we find out that, well, she found out. This is when she found out the three men are actually brothers. 29-year-old Alan Fryer, known as the Boss. 24-year-old David, known as Hatchet Face. That's a nickname I don't think I'd ever won. Doesn't even make you sound like scary. It just, yeah. Anyway, and 21-year-old James, who was Junior or JR. David Fryer actually had a prior arrest for shooting at people out of the window of a moving vehicle, and he took a plea deal. Now, Alan at first claimed that Sandra's friends were the ones shooting at him and his brothers, accidentally killing their friend. But by his third interview, he finally told the truth, but kept trying to justify their actions, saying that the kids were drinking and smoking marijuana and they wanted to steal it. Now, there was no alcohol involved. There was none. The kids didn't have alcohol. David's testimony was basically the same as Sandra's. He said that he had spied on the group of teenagers while his brothers positioned themselves with their guns pointed at the teens. And he reported back, and they came up with this ploy. They were under the impression that narcotics agents could kill drug users, which, okay, first of all, dude, it's pot. Like, it's not even really like a drug. Is it a drug? Yes, by standards, sure. Technically, whatever. It's not like they're out there doing cocaine or they're out there doing LSD. You know, it's pot. Also, why on earth would narcotics agents just be able to walk up and kill somebody doing drugs? I'm sure if it's like a defending their life thing, sure. But come on. Now, James, however, gave a much different story. He blamed his brothers, confirmed David's story about Alan impersonating a detective, and said that Sandra was laughing and having a great time, and she even had sex with him and David willingly. Now, come on now. He also blamed David for killing all four teenage boys when Alan left with Sandra. Now, I believe James was just trying to lessen his involvement because he was actually serving time in jail, but was on a work release program. And that evening, instead of returning back to the jail, David called saying that he was James's boss and that he needed him to stay and work an extra shift. But as we know, that's not actually what happened. The same day, the New York Times printed the headline, "Three brothers captured without resistance and charged with murder in the shotgun slayings of four Sioux Falls teenagers on November 17th. Now, Alan and David were moved from Sioux Falls, South Dakota to Leon County, Rock Rapids, Iowa. James stayed in Sioux Falls due to his current jail sentence. And on December 1st, the brothers were charged with murder, and each bond was set at $400,000, which it was $100,000 per murdered boy. Sadly, life was difficult for Sandra during the entire time, during the trial and after. And I mean, it's already hard enough to live with, like, the survivor's guilt is what they call it. But it was originally believed that she was actually in on the murders and that she was just keeping information from the police, and that's why she's still alive. And a lot of people asked, why was she out with four boys at her age anyway? Are we not allowed to have friends? Come on. No, of course, these rumors spread, as they often do in small towns, and Sandra became known as Gitchy Girl. She was basically shunned by the community, causing her to eventually drop out of school, and she was offered no counseling. Her father even kind of brushed her off, and she was alone and now felt shame on top of the guilt she already felt. She said that her mother worked a lot, but the Bade and Essam families wrapped her in their arms. She felt she was being judged at every turn, and for 25 years, she walked with her head down. In an episode of Killer Siblings on Oxygen, it was said that the family dysfunction ran deep, and the brothers all had very violent personalities. Their father referred to them as his chore boys, and they had a pack mentality. Except they all turned on each other and blamed each other for the murders and tried to put all blame off of themselves. So, you know, I guess so much for pack loyalty. Now, Phil Hammond, co-author with his wife Sandy, of two books about the night. One is called Gitchy Girl, and the other is called Gitchy Girl Uncovered. And you can actually get them on Amazon, and they're already on my list to be purchased. He said that they were criminals when in each other's presence, and they were always looking for the next crime. On February 12th, 1974, David Fryer's trial began. Now, he pled guilty to three charges of first-degree murder and one charge of manslaughter, admitting to killing Stuart Bade. He was sentenced to life without parole. One source that I saw says that he's serving his time at Iowa State Penitentiary in Fort Madison, while another one says that he is in Anamosa, Iowa. Alan Fryer actually had to undergo psychiatric testing to see if he was fit to stand trial, and he was, and it began in February of 1974 in Leon County. On May 20th, he was found guilty of four counts of first-degree murder, and he was sentenced to four consecutive life terms. Now, retired Iowa Bureau of Investigation agent Terry Johnson was quoted saying, "Alan wasn't the brightest bulb. after the boys were gunned down, and it was just him and her, meaning Sandra, in the truck, I think he became aware of her as a person rather than just somebody standing out in the woods. She remained calm, and they talked, and he just couldn't bring himself to kill her. Now, I think it's interesting that he was called the boss, and the other two brothers basically listened to everything he said because he didn't seem like the agent said. He didn't seem to be all that intelligent, but I guess you don't really need to be intelligent to be in charge of people. I guess you just need to be scary. Now, James Fryer agreed to be extradited to Iowa, but he later fought that. On June 18th, 1974, after Allen's trial, he and James actually escaped from the county jail. They stole a car and fled. Police were at Sandra's home every day in case they came back to make good on their promise that they would kill her if she spoke. Now, about a week or so later, they were arrested in Wyoming after hitting a pedestrian in Gillette. And the vehicle was described by a witness, and a large manhunt was dispatched. Now, on December 30th, 1974, James Fryer was found guilty on 3 counts of first-degree murder and 1 charge of manslaughter. He was sentenced to life in prison without possibility of parole. Prosecutors felt that since all of the brothers were serving life sentences without parole, they didn't follow through with the rape case because they felt that Sandra had been through enough and didn't want to put any more stress on her. Now, I'm not sure which source is correct, but one says that he and Allen are also at Iowa State Penitentiary, but another says that they're at Fort Dodge Correctional Facility in Fort Dodge, Iowa. During the trials, Sandra was on the stand for over 2 hours, but her testimony is what led to the conviction of all 3 brothers. Now, no one knows for sure why the Fryer brothers did what they did to these young teenagers. Reports say that they were trying to poach pheasants, but when there was none to be had, they then switched to deer. But once again, no luck. And so when they came up empty and stumbled upon human beings, they decided, why not hunt what is right in front of them? The brothers have all declined to speak to the media or comment on the crime, so there's no real way to know why or what the motive was. But what happened after Sandra was driven away was revealed in court. David said that James started the van and he got in on the other side. They turned, backed up, faced the boys, and as James got out, he shot Dana and then Stuart. Dana then shot Stuart, but said that he was most likely already dead, and they both walked up and just kept shooting. I just don't get it. Now, Leland Bade spoke out about losing his 2 younger brothers that night. He said the boys were best friends who minded their own business. They loved music and kept to themselves and mostly just tried to keep out of trouble. Sandra Chesky, now 63, called the boys her heroes. She said she believes that they were all trying to protect her that evening. She said it took her a long time to speak out and tell her story, but it has definitely helped her with her healing. And she actually tells it for her family as well. She now has grandchildren and nieces and nephews who are kind of getting to the age that they're going to start using Google, and she didn't want them to go on and read about that tragic night. She wanted them to hear it from her, and she told them that she didn't do anything wrong. She wasn't bad. They were in the wrong place at the wrong time. She also says that she can't really listen to early 70s music anymore, but she walks with her head held high now. She doesn't have to be ashamed. She was just a victim that night and nothing more. She recently returned to the scene with her husband and some friends to put the past and the ghost to rest. She also reunited with Craig Vinson, who at the time was 94, when they reunited, not in 1973, though he would be quite... Anyway, He told her that he never thought that she was bad or doing anything wrong, that he actually checked up on her throughout the years without her knowing to make sure she was doing okay. Now, I will never understand why people murder. I really just don't get it. Unless it's like a you or me situation, I just don't think I'll ever understand it. Especially children. Like, it takes a special kind of just creep who can just walk up to kids, just having a quiet evening, shoot them, sexually assault them. Like, I just for no reason. Like, there was just no, it was senseless and unnecessary. Now, I can only imagine how the families dealt with the loss of their children and the nightmares that I'm sure Sandra possibly still lives with. Now, I always like to tell the stories of the victims, but I couldn't really find much on the kids. Roger Essam, he lived in Sioux Falls his whole life. He was born in 1956. He loved music, he played guitar, and he painted. His mother actually had paintings that he did up in the home, and he planned to build a car with his brother. His parents actually died very shortly after he did. His mother passed in 1974, and his father passed in 1976, and they're all buried together. Now, Stuart Bade, once again, loved music. He took his guitar with him just about everywhere. And he sadly had a double funeral with his younger brother, Dana, and they were laid side by side. Now, Dana Bade, he was a quiet kid and loved music. He basically was friends with these boys as well, and taken way too young. And that's basically all I could find on him. Michael Hadrith, there wasn't really much anything on him, which I feel it's sad. I know they were young and they didn't really get to live life, but I think we should still talk about them. Once again, though, liked music, which I guess, you know, a lot of people do, but he's actually buried in Minnesota. He's not in South Dakota or Iowa. But on that note, I will see you next crime. You've been listening to Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces, a Pizza and Pigtails production. Created and hosted by Cassie Opea. All episodes researched, written, and edited by yours truly. Don't forget, you can find new episodes of the creepiest and spookiest content every Friday on your favorite podcast listening platform, and now YouTube as well. Subscribe to the Patreon page or the anchor.fm page for as little as $5 a month for bonus episodes every other Tuesday, a merchandise discount, and a Creepy Cases and Spooky Spaces thank you swag box. You can also support without subscribing through the Cash App and Venmo. Don't forget to follow along on social media, especially the Facebook and the Instagram page at creepycases.spookyspaces for all future news and updates related to the podcast, and maybe see some content that's not featured here. Like, comment, and share with your fellow fiends to get that conversation started. And on that note, I'll see you next crime.